change the way I
ever wonder why the cops can impersonate you, but you can't impersonate the cops? Some things you'll just never know. But one thing's for certain, there's no impersonating WUVT FM 90.7 Blacksburg, the greatest radio station in the world.
WUVT.
Before the land, before time, there was a time before land, when the world was just slime, and Krongoo was the brand. Yes, Krongoo green sludge was the popular item. There might have been better sludges, but no one ever tried them. Bought and sold by the platter, green slime by Krongoo. It was the most popular matter, it was the most popular hue. It was from sea to sea, it was from dawn to dark. It had thoroughly cornered all of the market. Colors were in absentia. Back in BC, 10 zillion. There was no puce or magenta or chartreuse or cerulean. No red, yellow, or blue. Well, to put it properly, there was green slime by Krongoo. It was a total monopoly. If you'd bought stock in Arrow, for a while it would have skyrocketed. It would have been mucho dinero that you would have stood to have pocketed. But if you missed out on that ship, then you have my sympathies, kid. 'Cause Krongoo's value dipped, as those slimy seas did. And land started to pop up in dribs and drabs at a time. And creatures started to hop up from the oceans of slime. Krongoo's grip started slipping with this slew of innovations. There was now competition from some new corporations. There were so many styles, and it all seemed so nice. These millions of aisles of life's merchandise. Some tiny, some giant. Some could chirp, some could buzz. Rebellious or compliant, with scales, feathers, or fuzz. Some were stupid as turnips, some were lowly as corals, some had high-minded concepts, dreams and ideas and morals. Some were fanged, some were toothless, some were sweet, some were salty. They were popular but useless, they were pretty but faulty. Yes, I guess I got fleeced. I got baited and hooked by each dream and each beast that didn't work as good as it looked. 'Cause each one crapped out and broke. Built to last, forget it. Get a refund, that's a joke. You can't even exchange for store credit. Someone do some muck raking, an expose, a news tip off. This whole store is a heartbreaking, fraudulent ripoff. Forget friends, family, dreams, hearts, trees, birds, dogs, snakes. Forget you, forget me. It's just cheap stuff that breaks. And in the land after time, and the time after land, they'll just roll out the slime in the most trusted brand. When push comes to shove, it'll be Krongu. No dismissals, no disbarments, no more tears, no more love, no more crew of disposable varmints. 'Cause before the land, before time, there was a time before land, when the world was just slime, and Krongu was the brand. Yes, Krongu green sludge was the popular item. There might have been better sludges, but no one ever tried them.
Some thoughts from John Cleese.
Ah, yes, the meaning of life. Well, as one who has often pondered this question, let me help. The answer is twofold. Yes, there is life, and yes, it does have a meaning. Okay? Oh, too general? You want more specifics? Well, I know just who can help. There is a philosopher near you. Talk to her, or him, at your local college or university.
A message from the Philosophers of America, celebrating 100 years of thought.
Thank you. no crowd anymore, no cars, no signals. But in the middle of the road, a purple and a mellow shape is floating, the shape of our mutual dream. Stay calm, hold me tight, give it a chance to take us away.
We'll be right back. You are listening to WUVT FM 90.7 Blacksburg.
A time bomb taking away this lump in my throat. It's been there for 10 straight days, constricting the airflow with the things I say. Get caught on the way to and from my brain. I'm tired all the time, but I'm staying up all night.
passed out in front of the TV screen. Turn up the volume, but I'm not listening. The dialogue is steady, and I start to panic.
Oh,
Do you love supporting underseen films? So do the creative minds behind Real Underdogs, a Hokie Run podcast that covers the lowest grossing new movie release every week. If you would like to know whether the latest box office flop is actually worth your time, you can listen to a new episode every Thursday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, SoundCloud, or wherever you get your podcasts, simply by searching Real Underdogs. You are listening to Stacks on Stacks, the University Library's radio show. It is Tuesday afternoon, so I'm Kira.
And I'm Joe. How's it going, Kira?
End of the semester is closing in on us.
Yeah, this is our last show until the summer.
Yes.
So we have a couple of days off, a couple of weeks off.
Or I think like 1 week, maybe.
And then we snap right into summer schedule.
Yeah, we haven't confirmed that, but we imagine we'll be in our usual 3 to 6 slot in the summer, which is like 3 to 5, 3 to 5:30 for us.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the option to go longer.
Yeah. I like this bed music. I'm too busy dancing.
Yeah, do you know what it is?
No.
Oh, it's the soundtrack from the film Breakfast at Tiffany's.
Oh, okay.
So that's the Henry Mancini Orchestra?
Yeah.
This is the Moon River Cha-Cha.
Okay. Yeah, it's definitely got that cha-cha beat to it. So do you have some announcements while I dance?
Yeah, I have something I can read. So we've been talking a lot about exhibits in the library, right? Over the last couple of shows.
Yeah.
Highlighting the work of our own Scott Fralin. So there's a new one that just opened today. There was a little reception at 2:00 this afternoon and opening an exhibit that has a connection to friend of the show and multiple segment guest, Taisha Thompson.
Yep.
And the Afrofuturism class she's been teaching this semester. So she was here a few weeks ago, brought a couple of her students in, and we heard some of the intellectual mixtapes they made and talked about those. And the, I don't know if this is their final project, but this is a project that came out of that class. She's been teaching down in the Athenaeum classroom in 124 Newman. Afrofuturism to Vibranium and Beyond. That's the class. The exhibit is a partnership between the libraries, Taisha, and students from that class. And a little bit from the description, it's inspired by Zadie Smith's claim that cell phones have become a force of isolation. Hold the Phone, which is the name of the exhibit, Hold the Phone, Communicating in an Afrofuturist World, imagines an Afrofuturist world in which technologies help rather than hinder communication. So Afrofuturism is a cultural expression termed in the 1990s, but dating back centuries, which harnesses the progressive momentum of futurism to envision a world with the African diaspora as its focus. The exhibit will be up until sometime third-ish week of May.
Cool. Right after the semester ends, pretty much.
Yeah.
Oh, we should put in a reminder that the library is currently 24/7 because we're reaching the end of the semester.
Because it's crunch time.
Because it's crunch time. So library is 24/7 right now. We are open all the time for all your library needs at the end of the semester.
So great for the students.
And also bring your books back so that Joe's shelving students can shelf them.
Oh, yeah. It's a busy time for us. So if you do want to sit on them over the summer, that's cool, too. I mean, you have like a year now, right? Do all patrons have a year?
I don't think so.
Oh.
Disregard that statement.
Disregard that last statement. I have something else here.
Okay.
Speaking of the summer, Digital Humanities Undergraduate Summer Institute at Virginia Tech. We are inviting undergraduates who are rising sophomores, that is, class of 2022, or rising juniors, class of 2021, enrolled at Virginia Tech to apply to a 5-day learning intensive on Virginia Tech's campus. Students will receive an opportunity to be among the first to interact with a NEH and ACLS-funded project. Students will work with faculty in the digital humanities and collaborate with their peers to analyze the Black Book Interactive Project data set. Students accepted will receive lodging and meals for their participation and be responsible for attending all 5 dates of the intensive. That's from June 24th until June 28th. Eligibility is 18 years or older, enrolled at Virginia Tech, rising sophomore or junior, majoring in a humanities or social science field. The application deadline has been extended until this Friday, and applications can be submitted via a Google form. If you are a student in the humanities or the social sciences, you could reach out to probably any one of your instructors in that field, and they can provide you with the link, or you can directly email Sarah Meese at S-A-R-A-H-M, as in Meese, 14 at vt.edu, or call the office of the Athenaeum to request the link be sent to you. The extension is 6737, so that's 504-231-6737. The deadline, again, was this Friday for the Digital Humanities Undergraduate Summer Institute at Virginia Tech.
Very cool.
Indeed.
So we have a couple of guests today.
Yeah. We have in the studio with us today Rebecca Fitzsimmons and Jade Snelling. Rebecca's joining us for a second time. She had been here almost exactly a year ago when I looked back over the notes, talking about the project Women of Design, digitizing archives associated with women architects. What's the name of it?
It's the International Archive of Women in Architecture.
Yeah. And she and Sam Nguyen visited us last year to talk about that project, digitizing those records, looking into this stuff under the Women of Design grant, digitizing hidden collections from the Council on Library and Information Resources. Rebecca's the project manager, and today she's back to talk about the progress on that, and along with her is digitization specialist working on that project with her, Jade Snelling.
And Jade has not officially been a guest before, but she has programmed music for us.
Yes.
And I think stood in the background before.
And she's programmed all of the music for today's show. Well, this bed music from Breakfast at Tiffany's we just threw in there, but anything we'll be hearing during our breaks, that's from Jade.
So if you like it, it's good, right? Please like it.
So anyway, welcome. Thanks for joining
Hello.
Us.
Thanks for having us.
I'm getting it all out. We got mics everywhere. I'm getting it sorted.
All right. So, a year ago, we talked a little bit about this project, and we focused on sort of the grant and what was going to be done and what some of the goals were for the project. Maybe we start with reviewing that a bit and then dig deeper into some of the observations and maybe... suggestions for further progress came out of the work.
Sure. So this project is, as we talked about last year, a grant to digitize 30 of the collections from the International Archive of Women in Architecture. There's many, many more collections that are in that archive, but these 30 collections are a selection that have been identified as being maybe less accessible for a variety of reasons than some of the other collections, either because, so that's where you get the hidden collections aspect of this, right? So either they're less well-known than maybe some of the other architects that appear in the collection simply by virtue of the fact that their records haven't been accessible in the past. So this grant is intended to remedy that by making many of those records, and we're on schedule to have about 100,000 files from those 30 collections by the end of June. So this is a huge amount of material from these different 30 collections, and what we can do with that material now is start to see connections between the individual architects within the collection. We can start to see their professional networks, and we can see materials related to organizations where they were working on behalf of the profession to sort of advance the position of women in architecture. And you see a lot of that, you know, in particular around the 1970s when activism really kind of ticks up in relation to how women are sort of being treated within that field. And there's a more concerted effort to kind of speak up and say, you know, we're here, we've been here, there's still a huge barrier to entry. So this is something that we need to all start working together to rectify. So anyway, what do you want to add, Jade?
Oh, yeah. I just kind of wanted to highlight one of the collections in particular I've been working on, and that is the Susanna Torre collection. And she's definitely shared many of her thoughts on the sort of state of, or the status of women in architecture, including writing a very good book, Women in American Architecture, that she introduced and then, you know, sort of edited and collaborated with other women on. But yeah, so a lot of it is about sort of addressing myths of hypermasculinity within the architectural profession. It seems to be especially egregious within this particular field. And so, you know, this project sort of also helps rectify some of those issues in that it does sort of show that women have historically contributed a lot to this profession and, you know, what exactly the contributions those were.
So when you speak of myths of hypermasculinity, it sounds like you're talking about the myth is not that women have not... the myth is not that it's been a man's profession. It's that the story told about it has been a man's profession, that it's a man's profession.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
Okay, so what you're uncovering is a different contribution.
Yeah, yeah, different ways that people can contribute within the profession. I mean, there is this sort of stereotypical view of the architect, like, you know, Frank Lloyd Wright is sort of the first example that comes to mind. Mm-hmm. But, you know, people tend to think of this, like, lone genius who managed to realize his particular vision rather than acknowledging the many contributions that people make to get a building built.
Yeah. So it's tied as much to the mythos of individualism.
Yes.
So it's also interesting that you bring up Frank Lloyd Wright, because a few of the architects in that we've been digitizing their records were actually apprentices to Frank Lloyd Wright. And so it's one of these kind of interesting things that arises that we don't want to focus too much on that while acknowledging, you know, that they trained with someone who is notable, more than notable, is a master of that profession, without eclipsing their own contributions by playing up too much that they were an apprentice to this other individual. And then when you look at the collections of these particular architects, Eleanor Pedersen, comes to mind. Her own designs are really incredible works of art, and her drawing skills and everything related to this collection is such a masterpiece in its own right. And you can see some of those influences, but then you can also see areas where she, you know, she developed her own style and her own ways of working. And so it's really important that we, you know, focus on you know, this kind of individual aspect, and then move beyond it to look at sort of the broader community of women that was developing. She, for instance, worked as a liaison with the in coordination with the Task Force on Women in Architecture as part of the American Institute of Architects. And so this kind of you know, narrative of individualism put up against this narrative of what the professional networks and community were is a really important thing to focus on within within the International Archive and I think the field as a whole.
Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the things that strikes me, I mean, I've been in Special Collections for 10 years now, so I've had opportunities to work with these records as well, not to the level of detail that you two are invested in some of these collections now. But something that Jade's already touched on that's always been of interest to me is this idea that these women who were practicing architects or designers or whatever their particular field was are the ones who become the scholars of that field as well. You know, you touched on Susanna Torrey writing that book, and we know a number of these women have worked to write books or articles or document this profession basically from the inside out, which I think is a really fascinating aspect of working with these materials.
Yeah, absolutely. And just to throw out a resource, it's not one of the collections that we're digitizing, but the writer Despina Stratagakos wrote a book called Where Are the Women Architects that I would recommend as a resource to anyone interested in the history of women in this field. And that was published in 2016, I think. So it's pretty recent.
Yeah.
It's interesting. She's touching on some of the same issues that were present back in the 70s and beyond. There's still a lot of the same issues that are coming up in relation to this field. When you look at the number of women who are studying versus kind of the barriers to entry, and a lot of that has to do with not just entry but advancement in the field. So there's often kind of a glass ceiling that exists that's very easy to identify. in this field in particular. And so you wind up seeing people exit the field out of frustration or maybe not have some of the same opportunities for certain types of construction projects based on some, you know, still fairly entrenched gender ideas about who's allowed to make certain types of buildings or who's allowed to get commissions for sort of those high-level show-stopping buildings. And that tends to be a lot of the narrative that we focus on in architectural history in general is, you know, the idea of these sort of show-stopping buildings. But the reality is a lot of architects and a lot of the women in our collections worked on residential projects and really shaped and reshaped communities in profound ways. And so when you look at vernacular in relation to architecture, it's almost in some ways a more important conversation than those kind of, you know, show-stopping buildings that we tend to think about.
So, yeah, so it's a related stories, right? I mean, you got the marquee skyscrapers that you're talking about, and those big buildings, those artifacts of like the field that they're held against this other thing. It's like you're drawing out the story of the small contribution and the communal contribution, and you're doing that kind of as a side effect to the focus on women, right? Because the women brought you into the areas of the field in which they had been operating, and that in turn brought out the importance of those areas. Is that fair to say?
I think it's fair to say in the sense that it's often an overlooked area when mm-hmm. we talk about architecture. And so in overlooking, you know, the importance of like neighborhoods and residential construction and how that can change the character of neighborhoods and the sort of ripple effects that has, we often wind up leaving women out of that conversation by default simply because they were doing a lot of those projects in favor of talking about these other kinds of projects like, you know, Frank Lloyd Wright or I.M. Pei or, you know, point to any sort of, you know, major skyscraper, you know, groundbreaking house, you know, these kinds of things. And so in kind of ignoring that other side of the field, we craft that narrative, maybe not purposefully, right? But we craft that narrative of the lone architect creating this kind of the idea of it, of the kind of genius that's wrapped up in that, versus the inclusiveness of some of these other parts of the field. And I don't mean to say that or suggest that in any way any of these women weren't getting you know, industrial structures commissioned or, you know, working on military installations or any of these other types of projects. It's not that they're just doing residential, because I think that it's also tempting to fall into a narrative where it's like, oh, well, women were doing residential work because of some kind of tie to like home or, you know, that it's sort of more natural for them to do residential structures. It just happens that those were a lot of commissions that they were getting, but that's certainly not the complete story of it. But, you know, again, in